like to start the meeting of the Transportation Budget and Policy Division. And today we are going to have an overview of the Department of Public Safety. We have Commissioner Michael Campion and Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison. So we're going to just get right into it. We are still awaiting a few members, but we will begin the testimony. Commissioner Campion.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Committee members, Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. With me here today is the most trusted Deputy Commissioner in Public Safety, Mary Ellison, who will be giving part of our, actually the thrust of our overview today. We have a number of different division directors here with us to answer specific questions that I understand, Mr. Chairman, the committee may have regarding insurance verification and the Real ID Act, so we are prepared to answer those questions. Mr. Chair and committee members, public safety is a little bit unique in that we have some of our budget that goes through the Transportation Department and some of our budget that goes through the Public Safety Committee. We will try to give you an overview of both of those departments, and we hope to give you a concise and informative overview. The mission of the Department of Public Safety is up on the board and is pretty plain and simple. We protect citizens and communities. We do a number of different activities. And I know oftentimes, committee members, that mission statements are bantered around, but well before I became the commissioner, there's been an institutional history of taking the mission of public safety very, very seriously. And since Mary Ellison and I have come up to the Department of Public Safety,
Mr. Chair?
We have tried.
Excuse me, I can't hear very good. Can you maybe bring that mic closer?
Senator Rossine.
Is that better, Senator?
Yeah.
That's much better.
Sorry about that.
Thank you.
But since Deputy Commissioner Ellison and I have arrived, we've tried to instill in the employees of the Department of Public Safety the importance of our mission statement. And as we go through the budget, I think it'll be self-evident why the activities in public safety are terribly important. Quite simply, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, somebody in the Department of Public Safety is charged and has the responsibility of trying to maintain the safety of citizens in Minnesota. And when people watch the news at night, oftentimes, whether it's a terrorist activity, traffic deaths, fire deaths, crime scenes, any number of other different kinds of activities, somebody in the Department of Public Safety is involved in that activity. Our 2008 and 2009 base budget, very briefly, is approximately $515 million. A third of that committee members comes from the general fund, slightly less than a third comes from the trunk highway fund, and the remaining portion is special revenue money. Expenses by category, when you examine the $515 million, 95% of that money is spent in three ways. Of the 1,933 employees in the Department of Public Safety, 49% of those monies go for their expenses. Secondly, the operating expenses, which include rent, fuel, and the such, is 28% of those expenses. And local assistance, which are grants to local units of government, which is about $95 million, or 18% of the budget over a two-year period of time. Very, very briefly, that is an overview of our budget, and Mary Ellison, our Deputy Commissioner, will get into the details, unless there are any questions that I might be able to answer.
Are there any questions? Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my
Deputy
name is
Commissioner.
Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. This is the time of the legislative session where it's a little bit, a little bit awkward because we come in front of the committees and give an overview of our department. And the governor, of course, just released his budget recommendations yesterday. And so we'll be back in front of you to talk about his budget recommendations, but today we're here to give an overview, just a general overview of the Department of Public Safety. And I just wanted to recognize a few of our staff that are in the audience because you'll be seeing more of them in the months to come as we talk about the budget for the next biennium. And I wanted to recognize Pat McCormick, who will be up here in a few minutes, who will give an overview of driver vehicle services. And we have Janet Kane, who is director of our Office of Technical Support Services. We have Colonel Danaski here, who's Colonel of the State Patrol. We have Tim Wesley here in the audience, who's an Assistant Commissioner of the Department. You'll be seeing those and others as we progress throughout the session. We have the privilege, as the Commissioner mentioned, of in our department of appearing in front of two different budget divisions in the House and the Senate. Some of our budget goes through the Public Safety Division, and some of it goes through transportation. So we're going to give you a brief overview of the whole department today, but I want to focus your attention on the fact that these following divisions are heard by this committee: the Minnesota State Patrol, Office of Traffic Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, Administration and Related Services, and the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is in the State Fire Marshal Division. Minnesota State Patrol, the mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and to provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. The annual operating budget of the State Patrol is currently a little over $70 million for this current fiscal year, and they have a staff of 782 full-time equivalent positions. Of their budget, $67 million comes from the Trunk Highway Fund, about $2.8 million from the General Fund, and $92,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. State Patrol services include the aviation section, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement. They have drug recognition experts, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, the training academy, radio communications, and a special response team. Driver and vehicle services, the mission is they are committed to fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and our business partners. DVS has an annual budget of approximately $45 million, and they have 512 employees. The Driver Vehicle Services Division collects about $1.1 billion in state revenues annually. DVS is funded by the Special Revenue Fund, so we get some of the money that we bring into the state for operation of driver vehicle services, and also receive some money from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. DVS services include title and registration, auto dealer licensing and inspection, prorate, driver exams, driver compliance, driver's license issuing, public information center, operations support, and e-business. The next division is the Office of Traffic Safety. Their mission is to provide leadership and resources to reduce the number and severity of traffic crashes in Minnesota. The goal is to drive down the number of deaths and serious injuries as low as possible. The Office of Traffic Safety receives an annual allotment from the Trunk Highway Fund of $324,000. And that's used as a match to federal funds and allows us to get about $20 million a year in federal funding for the state of Minnesota. The Office of Traffic Safety programs include traffic safety outreach, impaired driving programs, occupant protection programs, data systems, safe community grants, a motorcycle safety support program, enforcement of underage drinking laws, crash outcome and data evaluation, and fatal analysis record system. Administration and related services is also funded through this division. That includes our Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, Fiscal and Administrative Services, and the Office of Technology and Support Services. Pipeline safety, as I mentioned, their mission is to protect lives, property, and environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. Pipeline safety ensures the safety and inspection of close to 60,000 miles of underground pipeline throughout the state of Minnesota. They have a mix of special revenue funds totaling a little over $1 million, and then they also secure a federal grant also totaling a little over $1 million a year. Pipeline services include inspections of major pipeline projects, pipeline incident investigations, so when something breaks, they investigate it, enforcement, and damage prevention. The State Fire Marshal Division, the mission of the State Fire Marshal's Office is to protect lives and property by fostering a safe fire environment. Their funding includes a mix of general fund-based budget of about $2.8 million, some special revenue funds totaling about $1.5 million, an agreement with the Department of Corrections to do some inspection services for $91,900, and then federal funds of a little over $80,000. The fire marshal services include investigation, enforcement, regulation, emergency response, data collection, and public education. Alcohol and gambling enforcement is another division within our department. Their mission is to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state liquor laws, and monitor the state tribal gaming compacts. Alcohol and gambling's budget is about $2.4 million a year. They are appropriated $778,500 between general fund, special revenue fund appropriations from the Indian compacts, and fees that they generate from completing criminal background checks. Gambling enforcement is appropriated $1.6 million divided between the general fund, special revenue fund appropriations from the Indian Nation compacts, and also fees that they collect through doing background checks. On the alcohol enforcement side, they are involved with alcohol beverage licensing and permits, banned label registration. They investigate alcohol-related complaints and investigations of licensed premises, alcohol promotion and advertising. They actually don't do alcohol promotion and advertising, but they monitor that. Enforcement of underage drinking laws, and they also impose civil penalties. On the gambling side, they're involved in licensing of manufacturers and distributors of gambling devices. They assure compliance with state tribal compacts and conduct criminal background enforcement and investigation activities of gambling. Our Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division, their mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. Their funding is in excess of $100 million per year. $2.5 million of that comes from the general fund, and all of the other money comes from federal funds. They have some different branches. The Field Services branch is involved in community and emergency planning and the Community Right to Know Act, regional operations, state emergency response resources, training and exercise programs, and volunteer resource coordination. Homeland Security Branch has the Critical Infrastructure Protection Program, the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center, the Senior Advisory Council, Grant Program and Law Enforcement Terrorism Prevention Program, and the Urban Area Security Initiative Grant Program. The Preparedness Branch is involved in planning for emergencies, infectious disease and pandemic flu preparedness, Minnesota's Emergency Preparedness and Response Committee, and radiological emergency preparedness. Response, Recovery, and Mitigation Branch is involved in emergency operations, post-disaster recovery programs, pre-disaster mitigation and hazard mitigation grant programs, and weather awareness week campaigns. Our Office of Justice programs exist to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist victims of crime. The funding for this program totals $64 million a year. 58% of it comes from the general fund, 38% from federal funds, and 4% from special revenue funds. Office of Justice Program Services includes grants for crime victims, training and communication. They operate a statistical analysis center where they look at all kinds of different data related to the criminal justice system. And justice and community grants, primarily for law enforcement and to improve the operations of the criminal justice system towards the goals of reducing crime, delinquency, drug abuse, and violence. the 911 Allied Radio Matrix, or ARMR program. Their mission is to provide immediate access from all telephones to critical public safety services and to coordinate the implementation of the statewide public safety radio communication plan. 911 ARMR funding comes from 911 fees that we all pay on both landlines and cell phones in the state of Minnesota. Their budget was $40 million in 2006. On the 911 side, they provide the basic 911 service with selective routing and operate the enhanced 911 program. On the radio side, they provide and develop a statewide interoperable trunked radio system from an existing diverse and antiquated analog communication system. There are six phases to this effort. Most of you probably have heard this called the 800 megahertz system. Last division that I'm going to cover briefly is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Their mission is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota and to protect the public by providing accurate, timely, and complete investigative assistance, forensic laboratory services, criminal justice information services, fingerprint information, and training to the criminal justice community throughout the state. Their budget is about $48 million a year. 41.5 of that comes from the general fund, 5.4 million from special revenue funds, 1 million from federal funds, and then 361,000 from trunk highway funds. PCA investigative services include special agents and analysts, the predatory offender registration program, the cold case unit, an emergency response team, the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, the missing persons section, the Amber Alert Program, the Internet Crimes Against Children Program, the Minnesota Crime Watch Program, and they also conduct law enforcement training. The forensic laboratory services include a drug laboratory, nuclear and mitochondrial DNA laboratory, a firearms laboratory, National Integrated Ballistics Identification Network, the Midwest Automated Fingerprint Identification Network, the Fingerprint Laboratory and Documents Laboratory, the Combined DNA Indexing System, Breath Alcohol Testing Laboratory, the Toxicology Laboratory, the Trace Laboratory. They have a crime scene service, a mobile crime scene service. They provide training, and they also provide accreditation. Criminal Justice Information Services include the CRIMNET division, the Criminal Justice Data Communications Network, criminal history background checks, criminal justice reporting system, reporting to the FBI, the maintenance and administration of criminal justice information systems, development services, fingerprint services, technical support, and then training and auditing of all these different systems that are used throughout the state. That's a really brief overview of a very diverse department. As I said, some of our divisions that we talked about are covered in the Public Safety Division, and then some in this division. I know you have other things on the agenda. We'll certainly be happy to answer questions. We have people in the audience that can also address any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Several years ago, we built, of course, a very extensive facility in St. Paul for the PCA. I've heard since that quite a bit of the space there is vacant. It isn't being used. Is that correct, or is it all being used?
Commissioner Ellison, or Commissioner Camprin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Langseth, there is room for additional scientists to work in that facility. It is not, I would characterize it as not being completely maximized out. I don't know how many scientists that would require, but in the governor's budget, the governor's asked for 20 new scientists to address what's called the turnaround time. That is the time between the time when somebody turns in evidence and gets that analysis back. There clearly is enough room to accommodate at least 20 more scientists, and that's in the governor's budget. So the answer, you are accurate when you make the statement that the space is not being maximized, that there is room for additional scientists. But again, Senator, that's the way the building was built. It was built with clearly the idea of expansion and additional personnel to be put into that facility. It was not supposed to be full the day the building was built and opened.
Any other questions? Senator Olsen.
I'm curious, what would the impact of a gas tax be to the state patrol, say a nickel or a dime?
Commissioner Campion.
Mr. Frank Ahrens is here, our finance director. He would be much more equipped to answer that question than I. We've never had a discussion about it. I don't know. Maybe Mr. Ahrens could answer that question.
If I might add, too, it would be hard to answer the exact impact it would have on the state patrol because that money would go into the trunk highway fund, and then the legislature would have to decide how much money that was put into the trunk highway fund would go to the various activities that are supported by that fund. So it would be hard for us to say at this point what impact that would have on state patrol.
Senator Olsen.
Okay. I have another concern, and that's what are there plans for helping, you know, local counties and local police departments getting to the 800 megahertz? I know you are building the backbone, but is there a time frame to get this accomplished in the state?
Deputy Commissioner Allison.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, when you read the governor's proposal, I think you'll see that there's a significant commitment to getting the program up and running throughout the whole state of Minnesota and assisting locals with their costs of the program. So without going into great bit of detail at this point, that would be the general statement I could make. And if there are others that would want to be more specific, I would invite you to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the other consideration is I think by the end of 2008, the corridors between Minneapolis-St. Paul and Rochester and St. Cloud will be built out, and most of those agencies will be on the system, which would account, I think, roughly for pretty close to 75% of the population covered by an interoperable radio system in the state of Minnesota. Certainly the greater Minnesota areas, the less population, would be a little bit of a challenge certainly to build those up because of the geography, but the vast majority of the population centers would be covered by an interoperable system.
Thanks.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to know is in the Department of Vehicle Services, the Driver Vehicle Services, you've got a $45 million annual budget and it generates close to $1.1 billion. How is that money, where does it go? How much is into the general fund and where else is that money's going?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the majority of the money that's collected by driver vehicle services is the motor vehicle registration tax, and that does go to the highway user tax distribution fund. There is also a collection of the motor vehicle excise tax, and that goes to the general fund.
Thank you, Mr. Ahrens. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, of that, when you say percentage, how much is that approximately? Is that three-quarters, half, the amount that's going into the highway user fund?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Frank Ahrens, Finance Director for Public Safety. If you'll give me a minute, I'll look up those numbers for you.
Thank you, Director. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whoever can answer this one, I noticed $40 million between 911 and the armor funding. I was just wondering if we knew what approximately the split was in 06 out of that $40 million.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, we'll look it up. He has everything you want to know in this book right here. So as soon as he locates it, we'll get it to you.
Commissioner Campion, does the gang strike force come out of this budget?
Mr. Chair, the gang strike force comes out of the public safety area of our budget.
And what's
so
the plan?
Yes,
it does.
It is
okay.
Funded through the Department of Public Safety. It's not appropriated by this division of the legislature. It's appropriated by the public safety committees.
Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, referring to MnOps, do they still enforce the guidelines for the federal government? Are they still the agent for the federal government? And is that how we come by a little over $1 million from the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gimsey,
yes. Allenson.
Mr. Chairman, response to the question regarding the tax collections, amount of money that goes to the general fund, the motor vehicle excise tax in fiscal year 2008 2009, we're looking at about $253,887,000. And out of the...
Could you move your mic just slightly closer? Thank you, Mr. Ahrens.
I'll repeat that. Out of the money going to the general fund that's being collected by driver vehicle services, the motor vehicle excise tax, total collections, what we're estimating to be about $253,877,000 each year. Collections going to the highway user tax distribution fund, predominantly this is your motor vehicle registration tax. That estimate is $647,835,000 in the first year, $652,656,000 the second year of the biennium. Those are the revenues that non-dedicated receipts that are being collected by a driver vehicle services division.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Any other questions from any of the committee members? I have one vague one here. On your 911 armor funding, you mentioned that it's paid for by 911 fees. Isn't it correct that 911 fees are not collected on voice over IP?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that originally was the case, but now Vonage, which is the major voice over IP provider, has agreed to pay those 911 fees. Is that correct? That's correct.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, in response to another question I asked the 911 Emergency Services Armor Program, I think there was a question regarding what amount was spent on radios versus amount that was spent on the armor system itself. And I don't know if you have what budget books you have in front of you, but I can tell you that we have in the forecasted base for fiscal years 2008 and 9 out of the $41,571,000 appropriated each year as our base dollars, that $8,242,000 of that is transferred to the Department of Finance each year to pay for the principal and interest payments on from bond sales. Part of that is bond sales that are made by the Met Council, and part of that is principal and interest payments on recent bond sales by Department of Finance for Phase 3 of the Armor Program. And there are some overall maintenance costs for the backbone as well, which is approximately $1 million each year, which is transferred to the Department of Transportation.
Maybe we could have Chief Donansky come up if anyone has any questions of him. Perhaps you could give us just a bit of an overview of your responsibilities.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mark Donansky, and I currently serve as Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol. As Commissioner Ellison pointed out, the agency has approximately 800 FTEs, full-time equivalents. Excuse me. As of this date, approximately 550 of those individuals are uniformed troopers. Sorry. Agency is moving forward. We have a number of changes that have occurred over the past couple of years. Some of the members that have participated with us in our strategic planning process, the State Patrol is looking at doing some things a little differently in the future as far as the deployment of our resources, looking at putting our troopers in places where they can be more effective, in our traffic safety programs, and also in our programs to assist local agencies. I hope that we have the opportunity to come before this committee and the other committees to talk about your State Patrol and some of the initiatives that we're putting forward over the course of the next couple of years, and I will stand for any questions that you have.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief Dinansky, yesterday the governor said that he was going to put on 40 new troopers and provide the funding to do that. We've talked, and I understand the plight of a lot of retirements coming due, and people are going to shove off. This 40 is completely above that complement of the 550 uniform where we're at right now. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct. The governor has recommended a supplemental funding to make up for any deficiencies that we've had in the past years so that the complement that we have is paid for and that those additional 40 positions would be on top of that complement. That is correct.
Great. That's good news. Mr. Chairman and Chief,
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief, and for the committee members, the State Patrol has been kind of kicked around a little bit out in greater Minnesota for, some of the past practices. Just speaking from the standpoint of a lot of sheriffs out there, they're really impressed with not so much a new direction, but kind of a new attitude with local law enforcement. So I just want to say thanks. There's a lot of local law enforcement agents that are out there that are more willing to seek out the assistance of the State Patrol. And, in greater Minnesota, that's the only way it's going to work is if everybody's playing on the same page. And I'm glad that you've undertaken the responsibility of making sure that everybody's on the same page. And, I'm excited about some of the changes and some of the new opportunities that the State Patrol is going to have under your guidance. And, I'm not speaking bad about Colonel Beers or any of the previous chiefs. I'm just saying that, I appreciate the things that you've brought to the table, and I think it's going to work out great in greater Minnesota, and the metropolitan area is going to see the benefits of that also.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman and Chief, you shouldn't pick a fight with those door jams. They don't give.
Recognized.
Senator Steven.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Chief. I seem to recall from testimony, maybe it was last year, that the Minnesota troopers, the proportion of troopers we have statewide is very low in comparison to pretty much all the other 49 states. Do you know if that's correct off the top of your head?
Chief Dinansky.
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct. The last numbers that we got from the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the state and provincial police, would indicate that in a number of categories, such as the ratio of troopers to licensed drivers, the ratio of troopers to licensed motor vehicles, the ratio of troopers to any number of other indicators, puts us in the lower end. We're anywhere from 45th to 47th in those categories. I would also point out, though, that although the proportion is low, as a whole, the state of Minnesota does relatively well in its traffic safety programs. And I think that that's because the state of Minnesota is unique in some respects. We have a very strong Office of Traffic Safety that works with us and our local partners, what we refer to as our allied agencies, in putting forth very effective traffic programs. And so consequently, while we have a low ratio of troopers in a number of categories, we also have one of the best traffic safety ratios in the country. I believe right now, and I would turn to my friend from OTS, I think we're probably number 4 or 5 in the fatality rate per 100 million miles driven in the country. So although the rates are low, we do believe that we're relatively successful in our mission.
Any other questions? I have another question about officer safety. What's the record been, and how's the record been improving on officer safety?
As you're probably, Mr. Chair, as you're probably aware, if you watched the news over the last couple of days, we had another trooper struck just 2 days ago, suffered some minor injuries, a broken arm. As you're well aware, a couple of years ago, the legislature passed what's referred to as a Ted Foss law following the tragic fatality of one of our troopers. We work very diligently not only with the Minnesota State Patrol, but with other law enforcement agencies, with the local sheriff's departments, police departments, with the towing companies, and the emergency medical services, and I might add the Department of Transportation, in working out what we call work zone safety plans. And that is, as troopers and law enforcement officers are working out on the highways, that becomes our work zone. And we're trying to develop plans and protocols so that we do develop a process where law enforcement officers and people that are working out on a highway are cognizant of what's happening around them and make them aware of the dangers that are out there. And we're moving forward with a lot of plans. We have a highway safety committee that's on the law enforcement side. We're working with the fire marshal's office, as a matter of fact, in putting joint programs together so that as the fire departments and law enforcement officers respond to incidents on the freeways, we're all on the same page about what kind of safety issues there are going on out there. So while we do still have some incidents, we wouldn't like to have any, but by the nature of the work that's out there, there are a lot of cars traveling very, very fast, and sometimes the weather isn't very good, and it's one of those pieces where I don't think that people realize a lot of times that law enforcement officers, probably the most dangerous aspect of their job is the traffic stop, and not necessarily because the individual is going to jump out with a weapon or a knife, but because there's 2,000 pounds of metal screaming past you at 70 miles an hour about every 3 seconds, and we lose far more officers across the country to traffic crashes and traffic fatalities than we do to any other type of fatal action.
Thank you. And I guess related to that and related to what you were saying, the incidence or the frequency of inattentive driving, have you noticed that that has gone up, and what would it be related to?
Mr. Chair, I believe that that's indicative of today's society, where we have far more things happening inside of our motor vehicles than we ever had in the past. Before it was just a radio, and then it went up to an FM radio, and then a cassette, and then a CD, and now it's not uncommon to have small television screens hanging down all across it. Everybody's on at least one cell phone, if not two, working on a PDA, possibly reading a paper or a book, maybe putting some makeup on. We're a society that we have to get someplace very, very quickly, and we take driving for granted very often. We feel we're able to multitask, and unfortunately that's not the case. We're finding far more inattentive driving cases are causing crashes. As a matter of fact, I believe that inattentive driving in the state of Minnesota is rated as the number three causation factor of our crashes behind speed and impaired driving. So we recognize that. Unfortunately, it's one of those instances where it's hard to take enforcement action against individuals that are doing that. Typically, it's happening in rush hour traffic where it's hard for us to make stops out there on that kind of thing. But we do recognize inattentive driving as well as aggressive driving as being two of those components that 10 years ago were not as prevalent as they are now, that we have to address and have to start looking forward to having some type of a positive influence on getting the citizens and the drivers to pay attention a little more.
Thank you for those comments. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Chief, have you checked on the progress of the development of some of these guideway systems in the highways that will kind of externally control the driving, so for all of these folks who are doing everything else inside the car?
Chief Dinansky.
Mr. Chair, members, as a matter of fact, the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and I believe with the University of Minnesota's Center for Transportation Studies, has done a considerable amount of work in that area. If I recall, a couple of years ago, they had a snowplow that was equipped with a certain type of special equipment that allowed it to travel without the use of the driver, basically. And we did have a squad car that was also set up with some infrared equipment on it that allowed the driver to be able to see and have sensors do more than just the driver could do. So although it's not in our area right now, I do know that our partners over in the Department of Transportation are working on proposals like that.
Let me take that.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, I'm assuming when you were talking about that 2,000 pounds of metal going by at 70 miles an hour, you were talking in a 55 zone?
Chief Dinansky.
Mr. Chair, Senator, sometimes they do travel at 55.
Chief, what I'm wondering about is...
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Traveling down the highway the other day during the snow, and an officer has a stop going on the shoulder, and 90% of the traffic is moving over a lane to give that officer some protection. Are we doing anything about people, because I noticed that we had a driver coming through there. We're all going about probably 45 to 50, and somebody zoomed past 15 or 20 cars and put the officer in, I would say, grave danger because of the snow. He couldn't pull off on the shoulder very far. Do we do anything about that? Are we trying to get there?
Mr. Chair, Chemansky. Members, early on after the Ted Foss law was passed, we worked diligently with the Department of Public Safety's Communication Office and our own public information officers. Part of the problem is that it's imperative that drivers understand that the law is actually there. We still have a significant portion of the population that probably hasn't even heard of it, nor do they understand what their obligations are under the Ted Foss law to move over. And so although we do at times set up programs where we have a second unit that's available, you need to understand that more times than not, when an officer is at a crash, they're by themselves, and there usually isn't a secondary officer that's there that's able to leave that work zone, if you will, in order to chase down that violator and issue a citation. So it becomes rather problematic for us to it's not a, if you're going to set up a speed program where you're trying to impact some speed, you put people out to do traffic enforcement. If you're going to look for impaired drivers, you put people out at a certain time. The violation that we're talking about generally happens right around the officer, and you have to have additional officers there to be able to take action. So it's a little more problematic than the rest of our enforcement programs. Our public information officers are working diligently with the media, though, to try and advise people. And you've probably seen some signs and some billboards out there recently talking about the move over law and how important it is. Again, not only for law enforcement, not only for the Minnesota State Troopers, but it was only a couple of years ago that we had a fireman that was killed over in the Minneapolis area. And it's the emergency workers of all nature that are out there, including the tow truck drivers. Yeah, so we're doing our best to try and inform people about that. And when the opportunity affords us, we do take enforcement action.
More questions? Any other questions? I have one more. Do you have video cameras on every squad?
Mr. Chair, we have video cameras on every one of our line patrol officer squads, the majority of our line supervisor squads, with the exception of our administrative personnel. Probably 95% of our squads are equipped with video cameras.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Chief Tenansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next on the agenda is the overview of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division of the Department of Safety. And we have Director Pat McCormick of Driver and Vehicle Services. It appears like you have other testifiers. Would you please state your name for the tape?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat McCormick. I'm the Division Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And with me, I have the three program directors that work as part of our director team, and so I'll have them each introduce themselves.
My name is Joan Kupchinski. I'm the Driver Services Director.
Linda Long. I'm the Support Services Director.
Mr. Chair, members, Larry Olala, Vehicle Services Program Director.
Thank you very much. I believe Director McCormick is going to start.
Well, as commissioners discussed before, Driver and Vehicle Services' mission is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely services to our customers, both external as well as internal, as well as many business partners that we work with in order to achieve our mission and our goals. And as a result, one of our major initiatives that we're beginning to work on and we'll be kicking off this next week with our staff is to renew our focus on that mission in order to provide excellent customer service. And so you'll be seeing that there will be a great deal of emphasis on ensuring that we're responding to our customers, that we're trying very hard to produce our products, in other words, driver's licenses, motor vehicle registrations, and titles in a timely manner, as well as trying very hard to ensure that we're explaining why we're doing something and providing at least as much information as we're able and guidance as we are able to our customers. As all of you know from the calls that you get many of you receive. Our customers are not always happy, even when we try to provide them with that information, but we want to ensure that we're doing it on a customer-friendly basis and that we're trying to respond to all the questions that they have, as well as trying to make information available and accessible to them. Our Public Information Center we've responded during this last year to over 500,000 calls, and we also have exam scheduling that we do on over the phone through our self-service options, as well as provide exam locations, as well as provide driver license status to customers. I think that what I'd like to do is just have each program director just give you a background just on what they cover in terms of their program areas, so you have a better sense of how we're divided up in terms of providing services to our customers. So we'll start with Larry Olala from Vehicle Services.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Larry Olala, Vehicle Services Director.
A little closer with the mic, please.
My particular program area issues the titles for motor vehicles throughout the state of Minnesota. Last year, we issued over 1.3 million titles. We also are involved with the deputy registrars. We have 173 agents. They are both public and private agents located throughout the state. They're your vehicle service deputies, where you go and renew your registrations and transfer your titles. Working in partnership with that group, we also renew the registration of motor vehicles. In addition to that, my program area deals with the licensing of approximately 4,000 motor vehicle dealers throughout the state of Minnesota, and we also deal with the interstate carriers, the prorate registration of large commercial carriers that travel throughout the United States.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Linda Long. I'm in charge of support services. My area is responsible for the call center, and as Pat McCormick mentioned, we handled over 500,000 calls last year. We also communicate with the citizens through email, and we have interactive services that allow people to transact their business with us electronically, and those are done in my area. I'm also responsible for data privacy, which we take extremely seriously. We have the records of almost every citizen in the state, and so we're being very vigilant to make sure that that information is being used correctly. My area does the special plates. We have approximately 70 types of special plates that are issued every year, the veterans plates, the critical habitat, the collegiate, among others. And I'm responsible for the document management area. We take in several million documents every year, and we need to make sure that we have that we can access those documents and bring up information when it's necessary. And I'm also the director for the motor vehicle renewal program that sends out the renewal notices for all vehicles in the state each year. Thank you.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Joan Kupczynski. I'm the Driver Services Director. My area of responsibility includes anything and everything to do with driver's license issuing. It involves road tests, written tests, issuing the instruction permits. We do driver evaluations for people with multiple moving violations. We issue work permits to individuals who've lost their privileges because of violations or alcohol offenses. We monitor 125 different driver's license agents throughout the state who act on behalf of our department to accept applications in regards to ID cards, driver's license renewing of the licenses. We're also responsible for donor designations on the cards themselves and the actual issuing of the card, the actual entry of the information into our system so that the driver's license card or ID card is actually produced for the public. We are responsible for crash records, for anything to do with suspensions, cancellations, revocations, disqualifications, and then subsequent reinstatements.
Thank you. Commissioner Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair, I was, and members of the committee, there were two areas that the chair asked that I address the committee on, and those two areas were to provide you with some information about the Federal Real ID Act and kind of give you some background on the impact that that act would have on our state. And so I've provided you with two handouts that discuss, well, first one is basically a summary of the Real ID Act and then also what the impact on the state would be. And so just briefly, I'd like to go through those with you and then certainly respond to questions. And but the Real ID Act requires all states to comply with the Department of Homeland Security's regulations in order to ensure that the security of driver's licenses and the authentication of each individual who holds a driver's license or ID card. States are required to comply with these regulations in order for our state residents who have driver's licenses to be able to enter federal buildings, to be able to fly on commercial airlines, and also to be able to enter into any power plants or public utility plants. The Act states that the state would have to meet all of its requirements, and then there would be a designation on all driver's licenses and ID cards that would state use for official purpose, which would mean that we were in compliance with the Real ID Act. And it mandates uniform security features that all cards will have to have. It mandates a federated licensing system. In other words, all states have to be able to tie into federal systems in order to verify identity. And those systems that they're talking about are systems with the Department of State, with immigration, with vital statistics, or in terms of birth certificates, as well as the Social Security Administration. And it also requires that there will not be any variances or flexibility in terms of these regulations in order for the state to be in compliance with the Real ID Act. The Act itself contains $40 million to be able to be appropriated to states in order to address the state's needs. And the status at this point, the department has apparently finished their draft of regulations, which are necessary in order to move forward. Those regulations are have been sent to the Office of Management and Budget. They're under their review. It's expected that a draft will come back in the spring, and then final regulations would be available sometime next fall, with the effective date being May 11th of 2008. The next handout I gave you talks about the impact of that act on our state. The costs, the organization that all the state's motor vehicle agencies belong to is called the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, and they undertook a survey of every state to really get a handle on the costs that would be associated with implementing this bill. And that survey showed that the costs for all 50 jurisdictions would be about $11 billion. The costs for Minnesota would be one-time costs of $10.3 million and ongoing costs for the first 5 years, which is how long the state can come into compliance with Real ID. There's a five-year window that you have to reauthenticate every cardholder that you have on your system. In a five-year period, the cost would be $21.23 million over that five-year period, which would mean that the first year's cost would be about $14.5 million, and the expenses for the next 4 years would be about $4.2 million. We believe that in terms of our current residency and identification rules, we would meet the requirements unless there's more specific requirements that come out in the regulations, which we still have not been privy to. We also believe that we meet the security framework in terms of our actual driver's license. We have the features on there that would make very difficult, if not impossible, to replicate in a fraudulent card. And we also are in good shape in the fact that we have a central issuance process. Many states, as you know, you go in, you wait 20 minutes, and you get your card like you do in Wisconsin. You don't go through the second step. Our state, we bring in our applications. Those are reviewed by the staff at the counter. Those are sent to our office. They receive a second review by our issuing staff to ensure that they meet all the requirements. And then we mail them to the person's residence. So we're able to verify residence because we're mailing it to ensure that there is a residence. In some states, you've heard about how people use vacant lots as addresses. Nobody is able to check up on that, and we have a very good working relationship with the post office in terms if there isn't anybody that doesn't live at that address or it's sent to mailbox, et cetera, or whatever, those come back to us. So we believe that we're in good shape in terms of meeting those real ID requirements in that area. The area that we would still need to address that we haven't addressed yet would be that we would have to do background checks on all card production staff. So in addition to, we do background checks on our own staff in our division, we would have to ensure that background checks are done on all driver license agent office staff, as well as card vendor employees and all staff involved in all parts of the application and issuing process. So we think it would amount to about 1,000 additional background checks. We also would need to have security standards set, established, and then we'd need to ensure compliance and have annual audits of the card production facility so that our card vendor's facility where they actually produce the cards, there are, as part of these regulations that we haven't seen yet but that have been in the works at Department of Homeland Security, there will be very strict standards on what those card production facilities can look like, what kinds of features they need, so that you would try to prevent fraud at the production level. And then finally, we would need to implement the online verification systems with the Social Security Administration, Immigration, Vital Statistics, and Department of State. And the difficulty there is, in addition to us getting those programs online within our own state, and we have started working on that part of this, but they certainly aren't finished. The big concern that the states have is that these federal systems are really not complete in the sense that they would be able to handle the traffic that they would be receiving from 50 states, and in some cases are not really meeting the full standards that they would need in terms of up-to-date information. So those are some of the concerns that I think have been expressed by not only the association we belong to, but I think the National Council of State Legislatures as well as the National Governors Association have all been very vocal in expressing concerns. So our biggest challenge would be that if we need to implement this by May 11th, we would have to have time to spend reprogramming, we think, about 492 different programs that somehow touch our driver's license system within our own system. In addition, the other thing in terms of the survey that we did, we found in thinking through what we would need to reauthenticate each individual, because that would mean that each one of you, each one of us, would need to bring in our birth certificate and a secondary form of identification or a passport because we'll all have to go through that process. It isn't just for new drivers. This means that everybody would have to do that. We think it would add an additional 3 minutes to every customer transaction that we would do at our stations and at our driver license agent offices. So we may need additional staff as a result. So those are our concerns at this point in time. As I said, we haven't heard more about the regulations. Certainly we can keep the committee up to date as we learn more going forward. And I think we passed out also to the committee members an executive summary just so you have an idea of what's in the Real ID Act if you want more detail.
Questions? Senator Jungar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, it's so good to see you guys. You guys are really fun to work with. I got to know a number of you the last 4 years, and it's good to see you guys back here. My question, what I'm getting out of what you just presented to us, so I'll just tell you what I'm thinking and tell me if I'm reading you wrong, but it seems like another federal mandate, usurping states' rights, not enough money following. Can we just opt out of it and save ourselves a lot of nightmares?
Well, Mr.
Director
Chair
McCormick
and Senator Jungbauer, I think that the issue would certainly be that we think that there may be a need to extend the implementation date because of its, the practicality of it. It's hard to know in terms of how that will impact our residents in terms of commercial travel and those kinds of things if we don't comply with it. And so certainly there's I think that the working groups from all three associations have been trying to suggest ways that we could make it more workable and spread it out over a longer period of time and also make sure that the systems that we're going to be trying to interact with are updated before we're required to interact with them, because the one thing that I know that all of you would agree, there's nothing worse than any one of our customers going in and not being able to finish that transaction when they're there and have to come back or have to wait because the federal system isn't recognizing their identity. And so those are the kinds of things that we would hope that will get resolved. And there is some federal legislation that is out there that may look at some of these issues. It was introduced at the end of the last session. I'm not sure if it's been reintroduced this session or not.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. McCormick. Maybe we could just all vote here to send a contingent from Minnesota to the federal government and teach them how to do it right, since we know that we're doing things pretty darn good. We've made it very hard on identity theft. We've made it very hard to duplicate our licenses. I think we're doing a great job, and although it did tick me off, because for years everything I did was based on my driver's license, and the last time I went in, you changed my number, so I have no idea who I am anymore. But because of identity theft and things, and I think sometimes we need to look at this as state legislators and say, we do a good job here, and by gosh, we need to go reverse. Instead of the federal government thinking they can take control on everything, we ought to give them our input on things we do well, and we ought to meet with our Minnesota contingent in here and have you guys do a presentation of all the things we do well and work that into the federal idea if it needs to be done, although I argue whether you need this national ID card and all this information on it. So thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McCormick, I really appreciate your reviewing this. Is the numbering system that Senator Jungbauer referred to a part of this package, or is that another initiative, the changing in numbering?
Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, when we implemented our new card, we changed over to that new numbering system so that it was at the end of 2004. And the reason is that we were using a system which is well known. There's ways on, there's places on the internet you can go in and learn how to set up a card so that it would match a person's birth date, and you could take a good guess on when their card was issued. And so we decided that we needed to do a more random numbering system, and so we started it at that time. So the next time, since 2004, when your driver's license would be renewed, you would get, or you'd get a duplicate license because you changed addresses, you would get this new driver's license number. The other thing we made different is that that number stays with you. So if you go in and get an ID card, for instance, if you're taking your family and you have your kids get ID cards at a young age so they have identification, that same number will go with you and stay with you, so that your ID card would then become your driver permit number, would then become your driver's license number, so that you have that identity and it's kept. Certainly if somebody has their identity stolen, then we would certainly, there are steps we take and we are able to issue you a new number. But the whole point is it is to try to have one number track with that person throughout their life in Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman and Ms. McCormick, is that numbering system acceptable or compatible within this Real ID Act, or will that start a whole other system? Or is there any connection between the two?
Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, at this time we have no reason to think it would be different, but we, without knowing what these regulations are, but I think states would fight very hard to keep their own licensing systems. You know, we certainly agree that to meet certain standards, but I think we all believe that it should be up to the state to determine what system works best within their state. But at this time, I really don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. McCormick, this seems like a very overreaching solution to an identified problem, and it doesn't seem like it makes very good common sense, and it seems to place a large burden on the states, an unfunded mandate, and I'm wondering what kind of ability we have. I know you mentioned that there's these three associations who are speaking up, but it seems like something pretty significant ought to be done to stop this, and I'm wondering what the best strategy might be, how we could support this. It doesn't seem like this would be something your agency would be very happy about, and I'm wondering if our congressional leaders are familiar with how you might respond to this.
Mr. Chair,
Chief Campion.
Senator, the governor has a legislative liaison in Washington, D.C. As you may or may not know, the governor is going to be a chair of the National Governors Association come this August. When asked what issues of a federal congressional nature would be of interest here in Minnesota, I think we identified this as the number one issue. So
good.
Our federal congressional delegation, I think, is well aware of the problems, not only in Minnesota but throughout the country. So I think we've done up to now everything that can be done. Certainly the governor has been briefed, and in that capacity, come this August, he'll be armed with that information.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
So is there anything from our committee that we can do to support that effort, or is that not necessary?
Chief Campion.
Mr. Chair, Senator, not that we can think of, no.
Thank you.
We won't be afraid to let you know in the event that there is, though.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
follow up to
Senator Olson. Senator Bonas, the overreach and the concern of this federal ID, I think, is legitimate. What powers does this give the federal government in terms of access to information? Now, it will be a state ID, essentially, but it's got to link in with the databases of these different, the Social Security, Immigration, Vital Statistics, Department of State. Is this going to give any one of these entities access to information from the others of the federal? Are they using the states to provide the vehicle for them to communicate between themselves? Will this give access to tax records, financial data or information about citizens? How far does it go, or is there are there limitations within the information accessible and used by these departments, from what you know of the law?
Director McCarran.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, from what we understand right now, it's basically where we would present the information and they'd say either they're valid or not valid. So they're not retaining information. The only time that there may be some more interaction is if there needs to be further review. And we don't really, that's what we need these regulations for, so we get a better sense of that. The direction the states would prefer to go is the way we work with AMVA right now, and that's that there's a system that AMVA has for the commercial driver's license system, which has all the which is able, it's a pointer system. So, for instance, if we have an applicant who's from South Dakota that now decides they're going to live in Minnesota and get a commercial driver's license, we send that through this AMVANET system. We're all hooked together, and then they verify from South Dakota for us. They point to the information in South Dakota, but that way we're not retaining all the information. We're just, it's a pointer system. That's what AMVA is trying to suggest would be a better way to try to deal with this issue between the 50 states. So, but at this point, we don't really know what Department of Home, we suggested that to them, but none of us have been privy to what the regulations are. So until they're made public, we really don't know what they're recommending at this point. And the Office of Management and Budget may say that they'll go back to Homeland Security and say, you need to redo this, it's too expensive, it's not workable. So there may be some changes.
So Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson,
Ms. McCormick, for example, would they, in terms of the verification, if you're going to verify with the Social Security Administration, does that mean that they want to determine that we have a Social Security number? I mean, and the Social Security number obviously isn't going on it, but they want to verify that. Immigration, that verifies the immigration status, that they are either citizens or on some legal whatever. It's not identified on the driver's license, but it verifies that is the status. Is that the kind of thing that they're doing?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, yes. It's basically just verification of the information that's presented on that application. So it's not retaining it, and wouldn't, there wouldn't be any access to financial records. I forgot to say that, as far as I know at this point. So,
thank you.
How does what you just said jive with your executive summary back page where it says identity source documentation retention? There it says capturing digital images of identity source documents. Is that, will those be retained, and how complete will that be? Is that a variable number of images that will have to be brought, saved?
Mr. Chair, that refers to what we need to keep in our possession, and we do, when you apply for a license, the documents that you keep, we make a copy of them for our file so that we always retain those records if they're needed at some point. And those are scanned images that we have. So that's what they're referring to, is that states need to keep that documentation. We already do that now. So,
and do you use, for instance, Social Security numbers or Social Security cards for that?
Mr. Chair, the Social Security numbers are retained in a separate part of our mainframe that's confidential data that's only allowed to be used by the agencies that are listed in the statutes that allow for that use, and in Chapter 13 and in Chapter 171. So.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, can you repeat what the timetable is in terms of the state's response to this federal law?
Mr. Chair and Senator Mwaza, timetable, as we don't know for sure, but we're thinking that the federal regs will come out of Office of Management and Budget in the spring, that then they'll be published unless OMB sends them back and says they have more work to do on them. They'll be published for comment, and then they would become permanent next fall of 2007, with an implementation date of May 11th, 2008.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
So at some point, next legislative session, we would have to act to give you the money, or are you looking for the funding this legislative session in order to meet this deadline?
Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, at this point, we don't have enough information. We could even tell you what we need. And so until we at least see the draft regulations, it'll be very difficult for us to be able to even request anything from the legislature at this particular time.
Senator Moi.
So really, in essence, I mean, the May 2008 deadline doesn't mean anything from our standpoint.
Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, I'd say that was correct. I think the states have been pretty explicit that they believe that because it is a federal requirement that the federal government needs to be the one that would be providing funding for us, for states to implement this law.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moi.
The estimate here is that it's going to probably, and this is probably on the low end, cost us about 31.5 when you add the 10 to the $21 million to try to implement this. And I didn't quite remember of the federal dollars that have been identified so far exactly how much that would come to the state of Minnesota. Do you have any idea?
Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, no, they haven't said what they'll do, but $40 million would, we think, cover maybe 1.5 states, probably.
Senator Moore.
And then, Ms. McCormick, also, can you share with us whether you know of how other states have responded to this? Are other states similarly situated as us in terms of waiting for regulations, or have some states acted already in response to this that we should know about?
Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, I think states in general are looking at what will, I think we're at least looking at if we're in the midst of have an RFP out for a driver's license, some of those types of issues. We're trying to look at what we would need to make sure we're requiring in the, in a new driver license card. So we're trying to at least ensure that we have, different states are trying to ensure they have the security features they need on the card. I think it's very problematic for the large states, California, New York, where they're over-the-counter issuance. And so the thought of having to be central issuance is a very costly proposition. And so I think most states are trying to do smaller changes until we see what the real regulations will be. But I don't know for sure. That's just what I've heard from the working group that we have in AMBA. So.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
Oh, Ms. McCormick, am I mistaken in my understanding that at least two states of the 50 states have already passed statewide legislation to affirmatively reject implementation of the Real ID regulations, regardless of what comes out? Am I wrong?
Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, I think that I think there is at least one state that did. The second one, I know the legislature did that, but I'm not sure I don't know for sure if the governor signed that or not, so I can find out for the committee, though. I'll find out and get back to you on that to verify it. I just don't want to give you misinformation.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, and Ms. McCormick, thank you. I think that information would be helpful to the committee. I think that that would be an interesting public policy discussion that, you know, we as members of the legislature ought to have. If there are other states who are courageous enough to say to the federal government, thank you very much for your unfunded mandate. We're doing fine with what we have. I wonder how interoperable this attempt at state ID card would be if, say, 25 out of the 50 states says, sorry, we're not going to participate. I think that's something for all of us to kind of think about.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. members, as much as, you know, this is going to cause a lot of heartburn for a lot of people. I think it's important that we remember what the goal is of this program. And I think that I would hope that we could agree that the goal of the program is probably something that we need to work towards. My biggest heartburn is that we're going to be asked to do several different things that traditionally in Minnesota that we have resisted to do. And then we're going to be told to fund it ourselves, because we all know that when the federal government makes a promise of money, that it is probably hollow. And so I can see us having to raise fees for driver's license, other transactions that you make in your office, Ms. McCormick, to the point where our constituents are going to be livid. And any assistance that we can give your department as a legislature, I think that you've pretty well heard around the table that we're willing to stand behind you. I know that for a fact that in the state of Minnesota, we've come full circle on a lot of our issues inside your department and have made great strides. And I'm confident that if the federal government would listen to people like Ms. McCormick and your team, we would get something implemented that that was beneficial and it would be secure. And I think that, I would hope that through your discussions at the upper levels, that if the opportunity arises where we can be of assistance as a legislature, that you won't hesitate to ask for our assistance. I'm going to set that issue aside right now. I got a couple other things that I want to ask about. First, knowing all this, you know, that we're on the verge of maybe a different way of doing some of our licensing. Knowing a lot of the issues that have arisen around driver's license in the past and title transfers, I want to know about the computer systems that we have in play today. Do we need upgrades? What will those upgrades cost? You don't have to answer this now. I mean, this is all stuff that you can bring at a later date. But I'm sure we're going to need more money and more upgrades for our computer system to stay ahead of the curve. If you could be prepared with those numbers as we're putting our budget together, it would help substantially. The one thing I wanted to ask about was the insurance verification program, and this has been, once again, heartburn for the committee, for a lot of people like Senator Sinjum. I want to know where we're at today as far as the people who were dropped through the cracks like Senator Sinjum. Have all these people been reparated in one way or another?
Mr. Chair, Director and McCormick. Senator Murphy, yes. The people that were suspended and had their licenses taken away through the random sample insurance program, those actions have all been taken care of, and those suspensions are no longer, they're mm-hmm. removed from the record.
Okay, all their violations, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, all their violations have been vacated then, and it's just wiped clean. Great. In regards to the proof of insurance, and I read this report as we were sitting here, and
It looks like there's probably really no good way of doing it, and it seems like Minnesota is still probably, as far as compliance, we're probably in the top quarter of all the states. Do you feel we need to do anything further?
Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Murphy, the working group that was composed not only of department members but also members from insurance and Department of Commerce, the final recommendation was that at this current time, for the amount of money it would cost to implement an insurance verification program, that we believed that just with implementing the current laws that we have, we were still in the 10.4% in terms of the national average of uninsured motorists, which is much lower than other states who have implemented programs that we reviewed as part of this report. And if the committee members want to review that or the executive summary, I think our final recommendation was that we just continue to enforce the laws as we're doing right now.
Okay.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman Ms. McCormick, it's a $200 minimum mandatory fine for driving without insurance in the state of Minnesota, yet a lot of judges, if a person comes back with a verification that they have bought insurance, they will set that aside. I'm just curious, is there a way that we can structure our law so that the minimum mandatory applies to those who decide maybe not to insure their vehicles even after they've been to court? Basically, what I'm looking at is structuring it so that if the person does go to the court and show the judge that, yeah, I spent $620 or whatever buying insurance, that the judge could set that aside. I feel that even today, with the law in the books of being a $200 minimum mandatory fine, I think that got a lot of people's attention first. I don't know, and I've had some discussions with the folks over at the Judicial Center about, we make laws and then they kind of do what they do, and sometimes they follow some of the things that we have put into law, and sometimes they don't. I was wondering if there's a way that we could open the window so the judges could use more discretion in this area.
Director McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Murphy, that's something that we can talk internally about in the department and get back to you on.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair and Ms. McCormick. I don't want to hamstring judges to the point where they can't do their job, and I understand that in some cases, we as legislators pass laws, and then it doesn't seem that the judicial branch follows up on it. A lot of times they have good reason, and I think that we need to give them some latitude in this regard and maybe a few others. So if you could check that out, I appreciate it.
Senator Olson.
Chairman, Senator Murphy, I've thought about this, when I realized that we dropped the requirement that we put on it when our license renewal comes in, we were supposed to put on our insurance policy, that some people were either making up numbers or being insured, dropping it, that type of thing, which is why we went to this random approach rather than doing it. Is there... and maybe this is a risky thing, but straighten me out if I'm way off kilter. Is there some reason that insurance companies couldn't take a driver's license number and communicate to a motor vehicle that these people are insured with that company?
Mm-hmm.
Or
Senator
that they,
Murphy.
In fact, have ended their insurance? Is that a data privacy thing, or what's the problem there?
Senator Olson. I'm sorry, Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, they don't want it. That's just plain and simple, and I think Ms. McCormick can back this up. I mean, we've tried to do some things that are more creative to help us, raise the compliance rate. Our compliance rate is pretty high right now, and I do agree that maybe we should just let it lay. But Part of the compliance structure that we were trying to put into play would have brought the insurance companies in. They didn't really want to do that. They see problems with data privacy and things like that. It would have been a lot of information going back and forth. Colorado is a good test case for how things can start off with a good program and then kind of, I'm not going to say go seriously wrong, but they fouled up a few things. They had a private contractor as a data collection system between the insurance agents and driver and vehicle services. They were the collection agent, and then they were notifying law enforcement when people were doing things like that, dropping their insurance, stuff like that. Kind of what happened was some of that data got out into the open. It made a lot of people uncomfortable, and so the state of Colorado absorbed that system and put their own people in charge of it. Isn't that about how it went? Yeah, Ms. McCormick shaking her head, yes. So what started off as a good idea kind of got off track a little bit, and then they had to bring it back in. And you know, I don't think Colorado's compliance rate is even as high as ours, so I think that this is kind of a non-starter for the committee. We should just leave it go.
But Mr. Chairman, if we're serious about requiring insurance, then some, even if it was a direct communication, it would seem to me if that's a data privacy issue, that an insurance company couldn't send the state that registers them to sell insurance in that, that these people are insured in compliance with our law. What that would do is it would let motor vehicle with all the computer electronic age to be able to do a sort and determine that these are people who drive have driver's licenses but have no indication that there's insurance and that their license is in jeopardy without having to have been stopped. You could have a different kind of an enforcement. Otherwise, why do we have a right, if that's a data privacy, do we have a right to know whether somebody's insured or not?
Mm-hmm. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Olson, I do believe that the state has the right since we have, I forgot the last count, but in Chapter 160, I think we've got like 300 pages of chapter law saying that we've got the right to maintain our roads in a law-abiding fashion. So I do believe that we have the right. I think the rub with the insurance company comes. And first, let me address the issue about people dropping their insurance. You know, people aren't stupid. They know that if they go to insurance agent A, and I'm not going to name names, but and they quote them a price at $600 for 6 months. Then they shop. Okay, so that's the insurance agent that they've had for a long time, and they just send it in. One day the guy finally goes, you know, that $600, that seems like an awful lot. So they go talk to somebody else. And, well, we can do it for $425. Well, I don't know about you, but I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to save a little money and switch agents. If this guy reports you as being dropped and this guy doesn't report you as being picked up, you know, there's always that time delay in there, and then all of a sudden, you know, motorist A is classified as not having insurance, and you know, it gets really confusing. I know the state of Colorado spent millions and millions of dollars upgrading their systems so that they can handle all this data collection, and in the end, they're, you know, they didn't make a dent in their compliance rate. And I think the answer to the situation is to leave it alone.
So Mr. Chairman, just still require it, but not really do anything about it. Until people figure out that it really doesn't, it's toothless, then should we just abandon requiring insurance?
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's probably a discussion you should have with Senator Scheid. She's been the biggest push for to remove the no-fault insurance plan.
Well,
in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, that's different.
Senator Olson.
Well, that's
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, not really.
Yes.
You know, we have the no fault. That's where we're at. Everybody has to have insurance, and Senator Scheid.
But Mr. Chairman, no
Senator
fault
Olson.
Is a form of insurance.
Right.
Being required to be insured with liability is different.
Senator
right.
Murphy.
You're correct, but the state, Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I believe the state of Wisconsin does not have this requirement. Their insurance rates are, I'm not going to say substantially lower than they are in Minnesota, but they are lower. I don't know what their compliance rates are, but I, once again, I think ours is in pretty good shape. Besides that, there is a tooth in the law. That's when Chief Donansky is one of his folks pull somebody over and they write him a ticket, and you got to go to the judge and explain why you didn't have insurance and then beg that you don't get a $200 fine. I think that it does have some teeth.
Senator Moi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, something that Senators Murphy and Olson, when they were discussing, raised a point that I had wanted to ask. I'm wondering if do you keep track, or does the data come back to you on how many citations are giving out, or how many stops are made, or how many people end up in collisions who don't have driver's licenses?
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, that was what I was just going to mention to you, just so that Senator Olson understands that we do follow up. So if anybody's in a crash, we verify insurance. And we did over 92,640 verifications of insurance related to crashes. If they don't have insurance, then we revoke their license, as well as we do certainly suspend licenses if you don't have insurance. The fact that you attest to the fact that you have insurance when you renew your vehicle is enough proof for us. That's why we still require that attestation on our registration renewal and registration form, so that we do have proof, and so as a result, we're able to suspend and revoke licenses for not having insurance. And that's why we do believe that we are taking enforcement actions for people that don't have insurance. We're not doing what you're saying, Senator Olson, but we are doing that. We follow up with every crash report to verify insurance.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
What about individuals without insurance? I mean, without driver's licenses. Without driver's licenses. Do you keep any information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moi, we don't
Director
keep...
Director Chosinski.
We don't keep the information on the... We don't know the information on the non-licensed drivers. A person would have to be convicted, and that it's at that point that we become aware of the situation, and it's at that point then that we actually take action. But the driver that doesn't have a license, we wouldn't have information about that.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll look forward to working with the committee.
Very good.
This is actually a pretty good report.
No other questions? Well, this completes the business for today. The Transportation Policy Committee is adjourned.
See you later.
How are you doing? I saw you.
And I went.
So I saw you had 11. I remember that. Very good to be with
you.
Thank you.
I am too. Were
you right on the
ball? But you have to get
that keeps most people on.
But what that does was in the business.